copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
The title is Never Out-of-Date Essentials of Disciple Making. So for the first part here, you can take notes. It's probably better you just listen to me. And then when we get into the outline, I'm going to turn it over to Judy, and she's going to take it from there. So at the top of the outline, we have this term observable love, which means we want our love as Christians, or to say it another way, our love as Christians should be obvious. It should be obvious that we are people who have been affected by, captured by, and are growing in the whole matter of love. This word love is all over the pages of the New Testament. And you've heard this before. What I'm going to say right now, no doubt these first three or four things that I talked about you've heard before. One of the things that we need to do is develop a love for Jesus. And you've heard that real discipleship centers around Him being the teacher, Him being the master, and He is the one who must be the trainer. It's His life in people. And as we are growing as Christians, there should be a growing love for Jesus. One of my favorite verses comes out of 1 Peter chapter 1, which says, "Whom having not seen, you love. Even though now you don't see Him for a time, yet rejoicing with joy unspeakable." The thing that we discover is that when we become believers and we enter into a relationship, we've really entered into a relationship. And it's a love relationship. And it's something that we keep growing in. And we want to continue to do that. Another thing that goes right along with that as we grow our relationship to the Lord Jesus is a love for the Bible. As we study the Scriptures and we get into the Scriptures, we find that it is made up of living words. These are not dead words, but they're infallible, they're truth. They change your life. They have a living quality about them. And so we love the Bible. We study it. We treasure it. We put its words deep within us in whatever method we choose to do that by. And as we enter into conversation with people, sooner or later they're going to be able to tell that our lives have been affected by a living book, that it's changing us. A third kind of love that should be observable. There ought to be an observable love of Jesus, a love for His Word, but a love for His people, the church. Jesus said, "I'll build my church. The gates of hell will not prevail against it." We believe that the plan under the new covenant is for us to be members with the body of Christ. In fact, the term one another is used just over 150 times in the New Testament. We're told to serve one another. We're told to care for each other. We are told to encourage each other. Romans chapter 15, verse 14 says that we even have the ability, it says you're full of goodness and able to confront each other, help each other grow. So these are ways that we express our concern for each other. But the number one statement, and it's repeated over and over, is love one another. Out of the 150, it's used more than any other of those terms. And it's a very important thing. And again, it ought to be an observable love, because Jesus said to His disciples in John 13, "By this, my love, shall all men know that you are my disciples." So it's to be a love we have, but it's observed by the world. It even gives the world the right to judge whether or not we are His disciples by whether we love each other. "By this shall all men know that you're my disciples if you have love." And then, of course, as we grow as Christians and we remember that God's work in our own lives, there is a love for the lost, people who do not know Jesus Christ. Throughout history, Christians have been known for their love of those who do not know Christ and may even be enemies of Christ. Jesus told us, "Love your enemies and pray for those who despitefully use you." And as we go through our lives, no doubt we will encounter people like that. So this has been a tremendous motivating factor to go out and reach the lost. We discovered, as we studied the scriptures, these are people created in the image of God. Because of that, they have great value. They're worth spending time with, whether they ever become Christians or not, because they are human beings and they are people who are created in the image of God. Okay, I told you when I started that the first three or four things that I talked about would not be news to you. You've heard all those before, haven't you? And we seek to grow in our love for the Lord, for His Word, and to reach out to the lost and to love Christians so that this love we have becomes an observable love. Everyone in this room, I'm sure, because of the time of knowing the Lord, the work you've done and all, and walking in your relationship to the Lord, has experienced love to one degree or another in these areas, one degree or another. But I want to give you another one this morning we don't often mention, yet I think is vital to what we are talking about today, because it speaks directly to our humanity and how we are to respond to the world in which we live. And I call this the love of life. Being people who love life. We realize God has given life to us as a gift. It's a great treasure that we have. God has given us all things richly to enjoy, 1 Timothy 6:17 says. Every good and perfect gift is from above, James 1:16. As I said, life itself is a gift from God. And Paul said on Mars Hill, He Himself gives to all mankind life and breath. In Him we live and move and have our being. So God is a generous creator who wants us to appreciate and enjoy the good gifts of life. And if there's anyone who should be able to enjoy these gifts, who would that be? Those who know Him. We ought to be people who embrace the gift of life that God has given to us. Creation is a gift from God, and it's meant for our enjoyment. Perhaps one of the reasons we don't often think about this matter of the gift of life, is just because of all the other things that are going on all the time in our lives. The corruption around us, being burdened by sin, wickedness that we see in the world, sometimes dealing with that in our own selves. Many of us from the United States are concerned about our country, the U.S., which seems to be in a rapid moral decline these days. It affects us every day in one way or another. We're quickly losing cherished freedoms that we have had for a long time. And this comes in the area of freedom of religion and freedom of speech. These things we're starting to see these things being curtailed. We never thought it would happen. So these become daily concerns that we have. And then, if we really do care about the things we're talking about here, we have people living around us who do not yet know the Lord. We have some neighbors that we enjoy very much. They're not Christians. And the thing that comes across my mind every now and then, if these people do not know the Lord, they're going to spend an endless eternity without Him in hell. And so we're motivated, but we're also concerned by these things. Sometimes we are in the Lord's Word and so concerned about the churches that we're working in. Are they growing? Are they moving ahead? Are they maturing? And then there are always the financial and family issues, finances and things of that matter. But with all of these anxieties, can we give ourselves permission to love life, to enjoy life? Seems almost frivolous, yet there's so much to take pleasure in and so much to enjoy. We are those who love to celebrate the special grace of God, which He has lavished upon us in Christ. But there's also such a thing as general grace or common grace that humans to one degree or another share in. And the love of life is very much a celebration of common grace, which is actually for us enhanced by special grace as well, which God has lavished on His creation. We all celebrate this saving grace, the means by which God draws us to Himself, but do we celebrate the common gifts that we experience every day in life? There's a book called God Speaks Today, published by InterVarsity Press, in which John Stott has made this statement: a more grateful celebration there should be among us, uninhibited by our lingering evangelical asceticism. For the truth is that a world-denying Gnosticism has not yet been altogether eradicated from our theology and practice. Instead, we pride ourselves in our super-spirituality, which is detached from the natural order. And we look forward to an ethereal heaven, forgetting the promise of a new earth. We tend to have a better doctrine of redemption than of creation, and so are more grateful for the blessings of grace than of nature and art. Very thought-provoking statement.
Yeah, what is
like an airy heaven, a lack of material substance. Have many of you read the works of John Stott? If you have, you know that he was an avid bird watcher. And anyone who studied under him would be invited to go with him on his jaunt out into the countryside just to observe birds. You'd be taking your binoculars along. There's a young pastor down in Charlottesville, Virginia. His name's Corey Whitehead. And another young pastor, John Yates. And I was with them a few years ago in a meeting, and they both were interns with John Stott. And so they worked with him for a couple of years, and they were working for him to help edit things that he was writing so that they would be worded correctly and so on. But they said they were constantly being interrupted by him because he wanted to go bird watching. And so he would come in and say, "Okay, guys, I don't know what you're doing, but whatever you're doing, drop it. We're headed to the countryside." And they would head out to the countryside and take their binoculars with them. And he would tell them about birds, explain the whole world of birds to them, and all of these sorts of things. So he was one who really enjoyed it. I think we find in that a challenge to us all to take time to enjoy those very same kind of things. It was a passion and a pursuit with him, unapologetically. He enjoyed life. I will tell you that most of the Christians that I have come to admire carry the same quality. They embrace life. They know it is from God. And they become very enjoyable people because they've accepted these gifts of grace that God has given to us. And then John Stott goes on and he says this: perhaps G.K. Chesterton has put us right. And here's what G.K. wrote: "You say grace before meals. All right. But I say grace before the play and the opera, and grace before the concert in the pantomime, and grace before I open a book, and grace before sketching and painting," which he loved to do, "before swimming, fencing, boxing, walking, playing, dancing, and grace before I dip the pen in ink." Isn't that great? People say, if you don't know who G.K. Chesterton was, he was a journalist, worked on Fleet Street in London, and an artist, a prolific writer. And they say if you took all of his works and put them together, books that he's written, and all the newspaper articles, it would comprise about 250 books. So he says, "I say grace before I dip my ink and my pen in the ink." That's neat. Stott goes ahead to say, "We should determine then to recognize and acknowledge, appreciate, and celebrate all the gifts of the Creator, the glory of the heavens and the earth, of mountain, river, and sea, of forest and flowers, of birds, beasts, and butterflies, and of the intricate balance of the natural environment, the unique privileges of our humanness, rational, moral, social, spiritual, and physical, as we are created in God's image and appointed His stewards, the joys of gender, of marriage, of sex, of children, of parenthood, of family life, and of our extended family and friends, the rhythm of work and rest, of daily work as a means to cooperate with God and serve the common good, and of the Lord's Day, when we exchange work for worship, the blessings of peace, freedom, justice, and good government, and of food and drink, clothing and shelter, and our human creativity expressed in music, literature, painting, sculpture, and drama, and in the skills and strengths that displayed in sport. To reject these things is to abandon the faith, since it insults the Creator. To receive them thankfully and celebrate them joyfully is to glorify God, who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. The doctrine of creation has wide ramifications, as we have seen. It is the secret, he says, to developing a positive, world-affirming, grateful attitude to life, and of having a strong conscience which liberates us to enjoy the good gifts of a good Creator. Timothy, point these things out to the brothers, is what Paul says to him. So, despite our many concerns, which we will never be free from as long as we're in this world, we can become lovers of life. Daily we should use some minutes to take pleasure in what is around us. The flowers, the birds, a cup of tea while listening to Rock Bottom or reading a book. Weekly, we should take a greater portion of time, a hike, a bike ride, a drive to the mountains, concert, in order to have a change of pace and activity. Yearly, we should take even a greater chunk of time to renew our minds and bodies. Our mindset is to revel in the goodness of God's common grace as well as special grace and become a lover of life. And enjoy sitting in the atrium and listen to Bill Edgar play jazz. I don't know how many of you made that last night, but I sat there and listened. My wife went right over and sat by the piano. She's a pianist, and his jazz arrangements are just incredible. Gifts of God, which we as His people should be enjoying. What does this have to do with disciple making? Actually, quite a bit. If you love life, you become an interesting person, an engaging person, one who people want to spend time with. As you interact all across the various avenues of life, you learn to talk about a variety of subjects and relate to a variety of people. You see God over all of life and in all of life. I mentioned to you a moment ago neighbors we have who are not Christians, and we've lived next door to them for years. And we really don't have much in common in terms of faith, education, vocation, goals, and political views. We've seen many people we know come to Christ, but this is sort of like the Lord saying, okay, you know, it's me that does it, not you. We have them living next door to us. But we have shared interests with them who are humans. Due to the way God made us, the life He's given to us. That we are able to enjoy hiking and wild birds and wildlife we see around our property. We both have a creek that runs behind our homes, and kind of a wooded area. And We see owls and hawks and blue herons, and even more recently a bald eagle that perching in the trees behind our homes. We see deer regularly, and sometimes coyotes and foxes wander across our backyards. Our neighbor, and we alert each other when things like this come along, but he especially takes the initiative and delights, as a non-Christian, in these natural things. And he will give us a call. And we love to tell each other stories of what we've experienced that day. And we laugh a lot together and have pleasant conversations. This is building relationships in the midst of enjoying the gifts of life. So, an observable love of life will open doors, enable you to connect with people, whether they are in the church or, as in the case of our neighbor, outside the family of God. Love of life will keep you social, and that is very important if you're going to build relationships with those you hope to disciple at one point. Now I'm just going to stop right there and have Judy come up. This is a short share session that we have, so give me just a moment here.
And I want to say that in October, I will be married to this guy for 50 years.
Congratulations.
How about that?
And I have to tell you that it was his love of life that really attracted me to him in the first place. I was a very serious music student. Music students can be kind of weird because they get all caught up in what they're doing. And he kept me level because we met during school when I was studying music. And we met in the city of Chicago. And what more fun can you have than to run all over that beautiful city? But during all of these years of ministry and raising children and having grandchildren, Tom has kept a sense of humor that I thoroughly enjoy. And he doesn't get bent out of shape very quickly. I don't think I've seen him lose sleep very much over anything, even the difficult things that you deal with from time to time in church life. And so I have been the recipient of his very positive and curious attitude. He's one of the most curious men I know, which makes him adventuresome. And I like that. So I've had a good life because this man is a lover of life. Now we're ready for your outline, finally. And I'm going to go through these steps rather quickly. Basically, what I would like to do here is just give creative ideas to you. And I usually steer away from methodology. I don't teach methodology in disciple making very much because I really want to concentrate on principles and then let people just be creative with those principles and allow them, with the good minds and the creativity that the Lord has given them, to do what they need to with the standards of Scripture and let the Holy Spirit guide them. And the last thing I want you to feel right now is that I'm an American coming over to Eastern Europe telling you how to do things. That's my fear in giving creative ideas. But I'm also a very practical person. And having been involved in women's discipling now for over 40 years, I've learned a few things, and so if I can pass some of those on to you so that they can be utilized by you, you know, take what you can get from what I say here. So first of all, we're going to deal with purposeful care for those we hope to someday disciple. So I've got some points under there, and because disciple making is relational, it's very relational, you have to become a relational person. I'm not a relational person by nature. I'm task-oriented. I like to get things done. I feel very good when I get, when I'm productive and I do something well.
Well, Christmas. You are closely related there.
And he'll go hang out with people for hours. and I'm ready to get back home so I can do something. And I love being alone. I love being alone in the garden, and I love being alone when I'm cross-country skiing, which we did a lot of this winter because we had such a beautiful winter. And I love reading. I love quiet, even though I listen to a lot of music. I had to learn to hang out with people. So the first point is you have to be intentional about contact. And when women will say to me within our church, well, I would really like to lead a discipleship group, but I don't really know who to disciple, I'll say, well, what relationships do you have? And they say, well, I know so-and-so kind of well. And I say, do you go to the women's retreat? Well, no. Well, the women's retreat is a really good place to get to know women. Do you come to the church dinners that we have and sit and have meals with people? You know, if you want to put your antenna up and look and think, who are the people that need discipling, you've got to hang out with them. So you've got to be where they are. Just like the verse that we've said, Jesus chose the 12 that he might be with them. So that's the whole purpose of our developing relationships with people that we want to disciple. We want to be with them, so we have to be intentional about these things. Jesus was. So I'll quickly go to the next one, which is genuine interest. In making contact, we need to be authentic and not come across like this person has now become our project. We've got our eye on them, and we would like to corner them and ask if they can be in our discipleship group. I think our interest has to be genuine to the point that we really care about them beyond whether or not they would ever land in our discipleship group. Many times when I'm meeting with a woman to explore whether or not we should be in a discipling relationship together, and we can both tell that maybe it would be better if she were with someone else, or she's not ready because she's not really available at this point in her life, I don't just immediately cut off the conversation and say, well, bye, that's that. I want to continue conversation and express interest in her family and her children and what she is doing in life. So I think people can tell when they become a project. So listening and expressing interest like Jesus did. John referred briefly to when those two disciples were following Jesus. This is in John 1. And he turns and looks, and these two men are following him. And he says, who are you seeking? And they said, teacher, where are you staying? And Jesus very easily could have said, on the east side of town, you know, a half mile from here, take the first right, I'm the second house from the corner, and answered their question that way. But what did he say? He said, come and see. So he invited them to the place where he was living, and the text says they spent the rest of the day with him. So we notice right away that Jesus was hospitable, and he took genuine interest to the point of opening his arms and his home to those men. I'm very impressed with that. I think it's a wonderful example. The third point is sometimes you have to plan get-togethers when you're exploring group selection, especially who you would like to be someday in your group. And I call some of these things walks and talks. I'll invite women to have a walk and talk. Let's take a walk together so we can just chat. And or sometimes we can meet for coffee, or invite them over. But these this is all exploratory, and sometimes this is with non-believers as well, getting that relationship going. So sometimes you have to be intentional. I think we would all love it if God just dropped into our lives and told us directly who we were to disciple. And I hear a lot of people say, well, I just want God to show me, and I'm going to wait until he shows me. And I've had lots of discussions about that, because I think that we are workers together with God. And yes, we do pray, and we ponder, and we think, and we wait, and we're patient. But on the other hand, Jesus did take the initiative, and he did ask. And so I believe we can follow that same example. And I don't see that it's better for them to ask me than for me to ask them. I think it can go both ways. And then the fourth point here is hospitality. And the bottom line, really, in what I've been talking about is hospitality, opening our hearts, opening our arms, opening our homes. I happen to believe that the home is the perfect place to get to know people. But hospitality doesn't always mean that you have to invite someone to your house. We can be hospitable by inviting people to join us on something. We've asked people to join us at our family camp, and we sort of become responsible for them, and we'll give you illustrations of how some of those people actually came to Christ. I've invited people to, when I get some free tickets to the symphony, I will intentionally invite someone to go with me if Tom is not interested and doesn't want to. But I never let a ticket to the symphony go to waste, and I can always find a taker. But this is a really good means to invite a non-believer. You know, would you like to go to the concert with me? Or to a ball game. Hey, we're going to go to the football game Friday night. You want to join us? Or to sometimes a banquet is a good event, even for non-believers. After we are finished with this week, we're going to go to Lyon, France, because our daughter and her family live there. And we're going to spend a week with them. And something that I really admire about my daughter and her husband is that they are so hospitable. In fact, when we Skype or when we talk on the phone, I sometimes say, okay, Gina, who's living with you now? They always have people staying with them, eating with them, temporary residents. Sometimes it lingers longer. I know that right now they have a young Iranian Muslim woman living with them. And Gene and I have talked about how this is just the perfect pre-evangelism scenario, because the woman is seeking some facts, as she puts it. In fact, she's done some of her seeking on Wikipedia, facts about Christianity. And so she and my daughter and her husband just have some very natural, good conversations about the essentials of Christianity. And she is going to their international English-speaking church right now with them, because she is an English speaker. So I admire that, and I see the people that they have influenced just out of their home. This is right on the heels of hospitality, because the fact that we are convicted about hospitality, Tom and I are, and we've practiced it all of our married life. We really, truly love to have people in our home. We have gotten to know a lot of different people that way, but we've also seen the Lord use it, and that's what he's going to talk about here. Okay.
So, Judy already said that hospitality is a love of people, an openness to people. And I want to just show you something here. What you can probably use. seen this. I was with you in Romania and your group back in March.
Doesn't hurt there to see them again.
Okay, so you've I'm going to ask a question here, so you keep your mouth shut. I'll try to answer. Just take a look at this number of people here, and what the plus means is that so many children were involved. So we have Judy Harding plus three. She was a single lady with three children. Wayne and Ingrid Fishbeck had three children, and so on. Just take a look at that, and what would you say they have in common? Children. Several of them do. We got a couple of three. They've all been our neighbors, and in each case, when we met them, they were non-Christians. They did not know Christ. And so, as Judy said, why this happened, I'm not sure, but early on in our married life, we just seemed to see the need for this, and maybe it's because we just enjoy people, but we would invite them to our home. And I would say in every case, our relationship with these people began around our dinner table by having them just come to our home and have dinner together. Which that meant initiating a relationship. And I can tell you a story or so, and then Judy, if she wants to add anything to this, she can do it. And I'll just add that those names you saw span more than 30 years. So I'm not talking about a whole bunch of people that all just became Christians at one time. But in our neighborhood and the homes in which we lived, these people over that period of time entered our lives, and then some of them became Christians. And the first three sets of names were in the Chicago area. Then in 1981, we moved to Zionsville, Indiana, by Indianapolis. And these other people were our neighbors there. And the last one, Brad and Lori Willie, that you see, is a recent convert to the faith, to Christ. They moved into across the street from us about 2 years ago. And within 2 weeks, we had invited them to our home for dinner. They came over one evening about 6 o'clock and stayed, I think, till 10:30 that night. And we had a grand conversation. It was not our intention at that point to talk to them about the gospel unless it came up. We did get into discussing church backgrounds and found out that he had been came from a very staunch Catholic background. And we just had a grand time together, enjoyed one another. On Monday, I got an email from him saying, can we have coffee next Saturday? So I emailed him back and I said, the coffee will be on my back porch. Come on over at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning. And there he came, walking across the street. Missions you don't have to go for. Missions start right in your own backyard. So he came walking across the street. And we had another really good conversation, getting acquainted, getting to know one another. Next Monday, I got another email from him. He said, can we have coffee together again next Saturday morning? And so we met again at his house on his back deck to have coffee together. Well, he started asking all kinds of questions, and one of the things he was having trouble with was, what is salvation? What does it mean to know God? And he had grown up in a Catholic background, characterized by a lot of legalism, and it wasn't working for him. And we went all through the next year, and he would come to my house, and we would have conversations. He says, can I come over and report to you on my spiritual journey, this quest that I'm on? And so he would come over and he would sit and we would talk. And then probably about 9 months into the relationship, mm-hmm. I imagine it was, he called me one day and said, I have got to talk to you. And so he came over and he said, I finally figured it out. And I said, what is that? He says, what it means to be a Christian. And I said, what is it? He said, it's about a relationship. It's about having a relationship to Jesus Christ. And he said, let me tell you what I did. He said, I was driving down the road the other day. I pulled off the side. I turned my car off. And I prayed to to God and said, I want to be a Christian. And I see now that it's a relationship that I must have with you. And so he invited Jesus to come into his life. And then after he got him telling me this, he said, is this okay? Can you do it that way? And I said, that's exactly where it begins, is in a relationship with Christ. And since that time, we've seen him grow and grow and grow. His wife.
Which one is he?
Yeah, there, it's the couple at the bottom right here. Right here. Glad you asked that. And his wife grew up in a Pentecostal church. And when she married him, got away from that. They joined him in the Catholic church. And now has kind of reestablished her faith. And the two of them are just growing like crazy. I'll be starting a new men's discipleship group in the fall, and he's going to be in it. Judy's starting a new ladies group, and Lori, this is Brad and Lori, and they're going to be in that group. Every one of these is a story. I'll just point to the man, Pop. He lived across the street from us when we first moved into Zionsville, Indiana. And he liked to work out in the yard, do his lawn and things like that. And I would work in our front yard. We had a busy street in front of us, so we'd yell back and forth to each other. And then one day I walked across the street and actually started talking to him. And Dave had been divorced. He had a couple of kids living with him. But through that relationship, and by him coming to our home, right after he'd had hernia surgery, and I believe it was for Christmas, mm-hmm. we invited him. Judy happened to think of him a couple of days before Christmas, called him, said, do you have any place for Christmas? He said, no, I'm just planning to stay home. I just had hernia surgery. And he said, if I came to your home, I just have to lie on the floor. And we said, come on over, and we'll lie on the floor with him. So he came, we had lunch together, we didn't lay down on the floor. And I think played some board games together. He stayed until about 11 o'clock that night. Well, later he became a Christian. The sad thing I have to tell you is that he got cancer a couple of years ago and passed away. And I preached his funeral a year ago in January. So that's a sad part of the story. But one who came to know the Lord, each one of these is just a very wonderful story of how God works in the lives of people. Let me just add one thing here so you can see this. And we can think further about the importance of hospitality. Romans 12:13 says, pursue hospitality. Scholars can go check it. It's a command. And as we grow in discipleship, in understanding discipleship, I always like to say the better part of discipleship is obedience. It's learning the teaching of Jesus, the commands of Jesus, and having the courage to obey them. And so when we get commands like this, we have to seriously think about what they mean. All of us are called to pursue hospitality. We need to figure out what does that mean in my life. Yes, we know it means an open heart toward people, a lover of strangers, a care for people. But practically, how do we work that out? How do we make that work in our lives? Peter says, practice hospitality without complaint. Why does he say that? There are all kinds of reasons we can complain. But hospitality calls us to embrace and love people. And then Titus, this is pretty sobering. 1:8, it's also stated in Timothy that a man cannot be an elder if he's not given to hospitality. Although those texts, where it talks about being an elder in the church, he should be one who practices hospitality. And then finally, Hebrews 13:2, show hospitality to we're strangers, we don't know. But we're going to show hospitality to them. Okay.
Okay, now we're ready for point two. And this is purposeful care for those we are presently discipling. So the first point was how do we express care? How do we express observable love for those we hope to disciple someday? but now for those that we are presently engaged with. And the first point there is serving. Disciple-making involves serving. And if you are not a servant, you probably won't make a very good discipler. Not only does the discipler prepare materials from week to week and do research on tough questions, think of different ways to study a difficult passage or subject, but the discipler is alert to the physical and emotional needs of those he or she is working with. And maybe this happens with women more than men, I don't know. It's one of the reasons why I always have my discipleship groups in my home. I think they can get to know me better in my own setting, but mainly I can serve them better in the home. In my group, I know which woman needs a pillow behind her back because she has back problems. I know which woman gets chilly fast, and I can provide a small coverlet or blanket for her. The woman who has food allergies and has to have a special diet. The woman who was up all night with a sick child and is very tired this morning. I have another leader in our women's discipling ministry in our church who, when they meet at my home, I always meet with the leaders, and when they come and it's pretty weather, I love to sit outside. I'm very much an outdoors person. But when she's there, we can't do it because her skin reacts even to bright light. So you serve women. You make it comfortable for them. You make it easy for them to absorb whatever is happening that morning. I always serve breakfast to my group on Thursday morning, and I try never to repeat a recipe so that in the 2 years period of time, they really don't know what they're going to get. You can do a lot with eggs, by the way. So it's always creative. It's new. It's not boring. I try to vary where we sit in the house, sometimes around the table, sometimes outside, sometimes in front of the fireplace. So it's always interesting, and I just feel I can do that better in my home. I can just be more creative, and they can see who I am better, and I do want them to get to know me for who I am. So a lot of service is involved when you engage with people and you begin investing in their lives. Number two, listening. Listening is a huge part of disciple making. If you had to write down the name of a person in your life who's a good listener, would you be able to identify that person? I think we know when someone's a good listener, don't we? We can tell by their body language, by their eye contact, just the politeness in not finishing a sentence or interrupting. And when I have a group going in my home, I find that as each person contributes to the discussion, it's really important for me to make sure that I'm really hearing what they're saying. Because sometimes I assume that they know something when they really don't. Or they're stating something, but they don't have their doctrine right yet in this area. So I think there's group listening. And then I think there's individual listening. When I meet with them one-on-one, that I'm really hearing what they're saying. And I think being a good listener is one of the best ways to honor a person. I think it's observable love. When you, there have been people who I know are very busy, but when I'm standing in front of them talking to them, they give me the impression that I'm the only person in the world. And I feel like I'm the center of their attention, and I so appreciate that. I feel so honored by them that they would give me that kind of attention. The third area is equipping. I think observable love can be expressed in the way you equip your people We heard such a good teaching on this by Mark the other night out of Ephesians 4, that God gives gifts to the church for the equipping of the saints. And this means to prepare them, to provide for them, to supply them with the tools that they need. And this is ultimately what we do in disciple making. We want to equip people so that they, in turn, can equip others. I just love that paragraph in Ephesians 4 where Paul says, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry. That's what we're doing. We're equipping people so they can do the work of the ministry for the building up of the body of Christ until we all attain to the unity of the faith and of the knowledge of the Son of God, to a mature manhood, to the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ, so that we may be no longer children, tossed to and fro by the waves and carried about by every wind of doctrine. Rather, speaking the truth in love, we are to grow up in every way. I know in America sometimes we say, why doesn't he just grow up? And Paul says this here, that we may grow up in every way into him who is the head, into Christ, from whom the whole body, joined with which it is equipped, when each part is working properly, makes the body grow so that it builds itself up in love. That's a very meaty passage. Okay, and then that involves preparing good materials. Like John said, we often ask each other, what do you use? And I'm not going to get into the curriculum that has developed over my years of a disciple making, and Tom has developed a curriculum, only to say that if disciple means learner, if disciple means pupil, then there has to be content. There has to be knowledge. We can't just get together and say, well, how are you doing? You know, how are you feeling? That kind of thing. But there, we've got to give content so that we have a meaty discussion and so that it can be, something can be applied. But in addition, even to a curriculum that I've written, I'm always looking for current materials, articles, books, sometimes that we can read even a chapter or two out of together, that will make it relevant to the time in which we're living. That's one of the joys of being a discipler, is that you're always searching, you're always researching, you're always looking and studying materials. So preparing good materials and how they will be covered is just a major element in discipling. And I think that's a wonderful way to express love to my women who've actually committed themselves to me for 2 years. What an honor that is. And am I really worthy of that kind of commitment? Well, I think one of the ways I can make their time worthwhile is that we move in a sort of a systematic way through material. And then planned events. If discipleship is life on life, then we do other things together. I've already mentioned concerts, dinners. If my women are married, I have them come to our house for dinner with the husbands. Often we have them bring wedding pictures, and they talk about weddings, which can be hilarious. We allow them to brag about their kids for about 3 minutes. And just do kind of fun things like that. And so the men then get to see who their wives are with every week. We do outings together. Sometimes I'll just call and ask one of the women if she wants to take a bike ride with me or a walk. Weekend retreats. We almost always, somewhere in the two-year schedule of our groups, we spend a weekend together at a retreat center. And then there are seminars occasionally that come to town that we can all go to together and then discuss. And once again, this is all done within the context of hospitality. Hospitality to me, just keeps showing up all the time in disciple making. Okay, we're on to our third point now. And this is purposeful care for those we have already discipled and who are now reproducing. And this is the real joy of disciple making, when the people you spent time with are now doing the same thing. And I think that is the completed circle. I really don't think someone is adequately discipled until they are doing it. So that's what we want to move them towards. So I find that my life is filled with relationships because someone has asked the question, when is discipleship over? I don't think it ever is. I think those relationships take on a different dynamic, but you are always going, unless you move far away geographically from people you've worked with, but I think you will always have a really substantial relationship with these people, and especially if they become leaders of groups. So just as a practical example, I meet with the other women leaders every 3 months. We would love it to be more often, but none of us can manage it. We're all leading groups ourselves. Most of these women are involved with families and so forth. So we get together every 3 months at my home, and we spend a good chunk of time together, kind of report on how our groups are going, where we are with our schedule, with our curriculum, with women. But most of our conversations are theological in nature. And it really is iron sharpening iron because of the questions that come up in our group. And so we'll say, is there a better way to teach the creation order out of Genesis 1 and 2? How have you made this work? And then what about the creation order? Are we understanding this the way we should? And we all love our discussions. And I try to have fresh materials for them so that we can read stuff together and discuss it and say, what do we think? Do we want to include this? Do we want to add this as sort of a supplement? So we have to have scheduled meetings. And then the equipping continues. I get phone calls from the leaders of our women group saying, can I have a clean copy of that handout that you gave us 3 years ago, blah, 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 blah. So I look for that, and it seems like I'm always getting materials to women. And then answering questions, either via email or phone call. What do you do? I've got a real talker in my group. Is it time for me to get together with her personally, or do I keep just trying to divert the conversation away from her? Sometimes we have to talk about group dynamics and how to handle the person who's just very shy or very extroverted. Like I said, we do reports on group progress, but I want to make sure you understand that when we do that, we don't divulge confidences. When things are shared within our group that we are praying for, boy, do we protect that. And because we want the trust level in our groups to really rise so that we have good worship, that we have good prayer, and we have good sharing time, that this is an accountability group. And the women feel safe. And when it's time for them to divulge something that they want prayer for, that it's within a safe, protected environment. So we don't share things like that with each other. Theological, doctrinal questions, creative ideas for curriculum. Alumni reunions. Every now and then, this doesn't happen very often, because I've had 14 discipleship groups in our present congregation that have involved 54 women. I usually take four. So every now and then we have a reunion, and we just get everybody together, and then the people that they are discipling come. And then women can tell who discipled them way, way back then, and what they've been doing since, how they have used the material, what ministries have developed in their lives. And those are always very encouraging times. And I'll just say this, and I mentioned this yesterday to some of you, that if disciple making is life on life, you know, your life really gets filled up socially. That's what I'm finding. That's why I really can't do more than four women at a time. Two groups ago, I had four women, and among them, there were 20 children. And a lot of those children were teenagers, and some of them were our star football players and basketball players in town. So I would go to their football games and basketball because I wanted to see John play, because he was the son of Katie in my group, or Scotty played basketball. Birthday celebrations, I get invited to those things, and then when they get married, I get invited to their weddings or their graduations, and it means a lot to the women in my group if I can observe their children doing what they do so well. Some of them are very involved with music in our high school, and they put on wonderful concerts. So being a steward of time when you're involved in disciple making is really critical. And you have to allow space in your life so that you can do this. You can enter into their life and enjoy it with them, and support them in their weekly routine of even managing their children.